JB Knowledge Podcast Network.
On episode 85 of the InsurTech Geek Podcast, talking about starting up and scaling up InsurTech with Alex Bond from FinPro. The InsurTech Geek Podcast, powered by JB Knowledge, is all about technology that's transforming and disrupting the insurance world. We'll be interviewing guests and doing deep dives into specific tech we see changing the industry. We're taking you on a journey through insurance tech, so enjoy the ride and geek out. We are here as we record this. It is Friday, April 15th, 2022. For those of us here in the great United States of America, that means it's tax day. That's when we pay the piper. We take those checkbooks out and we cut those 50 pounds of flesh and send it to the federal government. Rob, happy tax day?
Yeah. No, not happy at all. And I'm still filing on. We have the extra weekend, right? It's technically not due until Monday for some obscure reason. You think it would be because it's Friday, but I guess there's some weird like local holidays. I guess people in like Maine and Massachusetts, because of Patriots Day, they don't actually have to turn until Tuesday, but the rest of us, Texas and elsewhere, have to turn on Monday. So I'm in the middle of mine, and yes, I'm going to owe something.
Yeah, no, my extension's already been filed. So that's the annual ritual of filing the extension on tax day. When your taxes are extremely complicated, it means that the extension's getting filed. With us from a country that doesn't care about American Tax Day. In fact, it's maybe they make fun of us for it. I don't know. It's like whenever I get to July 4th, I always think it's the we always joke it. What's like the Insolent Traders Day in the UK is July 4th. You know, it's when we rebelled against our British overlords. With us, not a British overlord, not a British oligarch. He's just an all-around British good guy, Alex Bond. How's it going, Alex?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm glad that I'm not having to live through tax day, because I don't know much about U.S. taxes, but I know it's enough that it's on almost every film, every TV program. Everyone talks about it around this time, so yeah. It sounds like a painful thing I don't want to be part of myself.
How does it even work there? Like, what do y'all do? Do you pay on a day? Do you pay quarterly? I mean, when do you file your taxes?
It depends on your personal situation. If you're employed, you're pretty much, it gets taken out at source. And unless you've got additional investments, you probably don't have to pay anything. If you're like me and you run a limited company and you pay yourself in dividends, then it's a little bit more complicated and you do it on a yearly basis. But just talking about it brings me into a cold sweat, which is the reason why I pay someone to look after that for me. Because I spent a few years battling that trench on my own. And after getting a few fines for getting it wrong or paying it late, I thought some things are just better to outsource. And that was one of them.
This is definitely one of them. Yes. Definitely one of them. I use a qualified professional, even though I have an accounting degree and studied this in college. I still don't do it myself. I shovel the paperwork and say, figure it out. Happy tax week to all those Americans out there. Hope you're doing well. Hope you're not paying too much to the federal government. And hope everybody out there in listener land is ready to geek out for another InsurTech Geek podcast. Before we get started, don't forget you can subscribe to the InsurTech Geek podcast by texting geekout to 66866. That's geekout to 66866. Make sure you never miss an episode. So if you're like live streaming this video on any of the places we live stream the video, we live stream on Twitter and on Facebook and on LinkedIn, and we upload the video to Vimeo, and then you know we're on all the different podcast channels. But you can just subscribe to the podcast 66866 to geek out. So back to you, Alex Bond from FinPro. He's currently founder and CEO at FinPro, where he's been for the last 7 years, but we are here to not talk about that just yet. We're going to talk about FinPro in a minute. Before we do that, I want to talk about Mr. Bond, Alex Bond. And all right, you're talking to a guy with the initials JB, who's named James. So needless to say, I love 007. Daniel Craig is my second favorite 007. He's my second favorite Bond. Of course, my first favorite being Sean Connery, because no one And I mean, no one will be greater than the OG.
I was getting nervous there, James. I was like, if he gets this wrong, I'm off.
Yeah, exactly. No one's greater than the OG. But you share the surname with the man himself. So where were you born and raised, and what did you dream of doing when you were a kid?
Well, interestingly, to your hobby of flying, I dreamed of being, I was obsessed with being a fighter pilot when I was a kid. I'm from a town called Chelmsford, which is in Essex, which is a sort of county just outside London. We're about 35 miles from London. It was fighter pilot. I was obsessed with that, but I have bad eyesight and epilepsy, so those things are not good ingredients for
Eyesight training. Can be overcome, but the epilepsy is a little bit of a challenge. When did you find out that you had epilepsy? When you were a small child, is that when it manifested itself, or was it later on?
Yeah, I was about 10 years old. I had my first fit at school. It was all very dramatic. Scared the life out of all of my classmates. And then, yeah, it's not something I suffer with now. They don't really know why, but some people have it and then it just leaves them. And about the time I learned to drive, it was no longer with me. But unfortunately, that still rules me out from flying very expensive jet aircraft.
Yeah, they're like, well, it happened before, so it might happen again. And
exactly.
If you we have a lot of flashing lights in airplanes, and there's a lot of flashing lights on the ground. There's a lot of flashing lights in the sky. And so I could see why they might be a bit reluctant to put you up there, you know, could be a bit challenging, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I've subsequently found out I'm quite scared of heights as well. So none of these things I was aware of as a small child. So,
oh my goodness. Yeah. What are you going to do with that? Right. So, so you dreamed of being a fighter pilot. You grew up outside of London. You go to college for business management, and then you jump straight into commercial insurance claims. What was it? You know, a lot of people don't like go straight in out of college into claims. They have like a couple of steps before they get into insurance. What about insurance attracted you to the space?
Well, you're looking at the rose-tinted glasses LinkedIn version of my career. So there was a point in time where I fell out with my parents when I used to work in cocktail bars, and I used to run bar consultancy. So I would go and design cocktail bar menus, and I would work in events, and I loved it. And I thought, this is what I'm going to do for a job. And my mother, let's be honest, was very disappointed.
To say the least, right?
Like... Yeah. She did not agree with me that Tom Cruise's Cocktail
was one of the greatest movies ever made, and I don't care what anybody says.
If you follow the theme of thinking, I'm essentially following Tom Cruise's career advice. Fighter pilot for Top Gun.
Yeah.
If that doesn't work, go into cocktail.
When he used to throw the bottles, and they had the big bar there, and then he ends up, what a great movie. What a great movie.
It doesn't hold up quite as well, but I still love it. I've got a big affection for it.
Are you saying I need to watch it again to get a feel for what
you should happened? You should rewatch it. It's still fun. It's still a lot of fun. I mean, I'd still encourage people to watch it, but I did a lot of events things, and then I did that during college and then at the end, and then my mum sort of was like, right, are you going to go and wear a suit to work, please? We didn't invest in your university for you to go and work in a bar. So, and insurance is the same story like everyone else. I walked into an open day for RSA that were hiring people in claims, and, you know, they offered me the princely sum of, I don't know, it's equivalent of about $20,000 a year, and I was like, I'm rich, let's go. And so I just stumbled into it like everyone else. That's my origin story.
Yeah, you're like, hey, why not? Sounds like a lot of money right now. It does sound like a lot of money when you're eating grilled cheese sandwiches and whatever you guys eat. You're not into Vegemite over there. That's your Australian cousins, isn't it?
No, that's when you're a student in the UK, I'm sure this is kind of universal. It's just you buy the biggest size of pasta you can buy in a shop, and then you And then you eat that with anything that's on hand, whether that be tuna, tomato sauce, cheese, anything. That's a staple. So yeah, that's living off that $20,000 is a lot of money.
Did you know the British are known for their health food? It's really quite remarkable. They're known for how healthy their food is.
I think our food's good. We really like trashy food.
You really like trashy food in England.
yeah. I mean, we basically are slightly in love with anything American. So if Americans are going, oh, here's some fast food, like Britain's very quickly going, well, that must be good because it's from America. We'll eat that. We're not the healthiest eaters, but we should be. There's a lot of produce here. We should be doing fine, but I don't think we're as healthy as we are. We should be.
It could be better. It could be better. Like 100% could be better. Well, let's talk about how you wound up. You went to commercial insurance claims at RSA, then you went to manager insurance team London at Hays, then you went to the manager at Eames Consulting Group. I mean, what were you learning through all this? Like, what lines of business did you work in? What parts of the insurance business did you really get to know before you jumped into what you're doing now?
Hays is my first recruitment job. So I didn't even make a full year in insurance. I was doing commercial claims. I was working with broking clients who had large fleets. I was doing a lot of auto. And I loved the client interaction. I loved managing the clients. Even when they were being difficult or demanding or hard work, I liked that side of it. And then I had a chat with my boss, and I thought there was a role called the claims relationship manager. And I said, I really want that role. And they said, oh, we can see you doing that in about 6 years' time. and that role was paying like $50,000. And I'm like, I'm not waiting 6 years to earn $50,000. Like, absolutely no chance. Yeah. So I couldn't get out of there quick enough. So I had two guys that I knew at university. They were doing really well in the recruitment sector. So I started having a look for opportunities. And then I was contacted by Hays. And they had, because I had this 9 months experience in insurance, they were like, well, you're an insurance expert. So you can come and work in our insurance recruitment team. And then I've stayed in the sector from a recruitment perspective in various different guises ever since. So
he must know what he's doing. He worked there all of 9 months. I feel like 9 months into my insurance journey that I was just trying to understand what the hell a policy was. Like,
I had no idea what a policy was. I don't think at that point. The first thing I did. So I went into. I specialized in claims recruitment because I kind of understood it. And I knew what everyone was getting paid at RSA because I was on the same wages. And then when QBE opened up down the road, MS Amlin opened up down the road, and there was a couple of other businesses, one called Highway. There was all these competing businesses. And I found out what they were all paying. So I just would phone my old colleagues and go, did you know you can get $5,000 more if you move down the road? And so I think I moved 9 people from my old team within the first 6 months. So I wasn't very popular at RSA, but they wouldn't take me on as a client. So bad luck for them. And I started well.
Suck it up.
yeah, exactly. Pay the money or move along. And but no, I loved it. I've loved recruitment ever since I've started it. I love that client interaction, and it's very unfiltered. Yeah, and you're providing a need, right? So companies can't grow if they can't attract talent, and if you can be the solution to that, then it's a nice relationship to have. So yeah, it's been that way since I joined Hays. Back, I don't even know the date. I think you've got it in front of you. I don't think I could tell you what year I started.
Yeah, no, 2007. Yeah.
There we go. So, 15 years.
Let's just talk about headhunting for a second. I'm not a big fan of headhunters, okay? I mean, you have some that are really good. And, man, you seem like a good guy. You know, you seem like a good guy. You got an industry where you got a lot of colleagues who just intentionally churn accounts. You know, they move people around because they generate fees off of movement. There's no fee generation if you put people there and just keep them there forever, and you do a great job of driving turnover down at your clients. And so there are markets where headhunters get really, really, really aggressive and just churn the hell out of the labor market in that area. And obviously that costs companies a lot of money. So, you know, tell me like, you know, the downside of headhunting and executive placement.
Well, firstly, I don't believe what you just said is true. So we've got to start there.
Maybe you haven't seen the IT market in the United States.
Well, I was going to say the technology market is a market where it's closest to being true.
Yeah.
But you can't move happy people that are paid the appropriate wage for the market. You can't do that. Like we're not magicians. We can't whisper in people's ear and magic them away.
Yeah.
We don't have that power, but we can present opportunities that pay more, that might have better incentives for them, that might have a better mission for them to be on. And if you as a business can't, unfortunately, if you can't match that, then they are probably likely to move. But people do move for money, but rarely. So it's usually about them kind of feeling more involved, more invested. So, but look, there are people that play the game badly. There's no getting away from that. I've worked with a few of them. I don't work with them anymore. And that's where I think the distinction comes. If you're genuinely an executive search person, you will have off limits with your clients, and you won't, you know, you can't place someone in a business and then with the other hand be raiding them for some talent. It's just not the way the game should be played.
Yeah.
And I think there's a difference there. The tech market is notoriously ruthless.
And that's been my unfortunate, experience level. It's not with insurance placement. It's been with technology. And I've just watched these tech headhunters just churn and churn and cherry pick from their own accounts and then move the people they already moved in and recruit them back off. I mean, and you watch people bounce, you know, between jobs every 2 years, and it creates just an incredible amount of trauma. But you know, the reality is, I'm also a regent at a public university, and I was a city councilor in my city, and I have very, very, very effectively used executive search in those roles. And could not, by the way, have done my job without the executive search. So there's always, I've got a flip side to every story. That's why I like to ask you where you've seen it. And of course, you've seen it in tech as well. Why do you think tech is so prone to this type of executive headhunting behavior?
Well, firstly, I would draw a distinction. I would say that's kind of like contingent recruitment behavior.
Contingent, correct. Well, not executive search, not retained. Yeah, it's not retained search, it's contingent search. Yeah.
So I think that's important because they are different methods of attack, as it were, for a recruitment professional. The reason we've seen it is because the wage inflation is so dramatic in tech. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, even in the last 2 years, you're talking about wage inflation of such a high level that it's very difficult for you as a business. You've hired some people, they've been with you 2 years, you've given them fair pay rises, but the market has decided that the new fair increase is 40% above what you're paying. So what do you do? And I have massive sympathy because you can't turn around and pay everyone 40% more because you would have priced your contracting work.
Correct.
Or priced your products.
You have to reprice all your customers. Yeah,
exactly. It's all built in. So you've got to just, unfortunately, except that some people will get those opportunities externally that are paying 40% more and move. And I think that's why you've seen it in tech, because it's you know, the tech salaries have kind of been reflective of the tech, you know, opportunities in the kind of public investment markets. I mean, the growth has just been astronomical. We hear stories of the big, you know, the big tech companies hiring people straight from college and paying $300,000. You know, for the best engineering talent. And you know, what do you do with that? I mean, that would put you at sort of a fairly senior stack in an insurance company. And, you know, sometimes you'd be better off going to university and learning engineering than learning anything about insurance and sticking with it. So I think that's why we've seen it. But then it's interesting for me because in the US, there are more recruitment companies in the whole of London than there are the whole of the US. London is the most aggressive recruitment market in the world.
Is that because of birth rates and you just have like a straight up labor shortage? I mean, we're seeing in all honesty, we're seeing in Western Europe, we're seeing birth rates so low that you end up with more workers retiring than workers coming into the labor market, right? So that naturally compresses your available supply of talent. Is it just because it's a really mature industry there, or is it because you literally are having labor shortages across multiple industry verticals?
It's more of the latter, that there's it's just a mature industry here. It's a much more mature industry. It's been around for a long time, and the problem, you know, it's a very low barrier to entry business. So you can work in recruitment for a couple of years, you probably know the bare basics, you can leave, you can set up in your bedroom and off you go. So anyone that gets good at it probably usually looks to set up on their own. So you've got this kind of constant evolution of new businesses coming in. I mean, there's something like 70% of all recruitment businesses are less than 10 people. So it's lots of small businesses. But then there, of course, is a labor shortage as well. I mean, I won't get too political, but we've not been too astute in our education system from a sort of top-down government perspective. So we're lagging behind in things like engineering. You know, we've got a bit of a mess of an education system with respect to kind of what's needed in the current work environment. So I think that's becoming more of an issue. And then when we do stupid things like leave the EU and make that harder for everyone, you know,
I can guess who's in any.
If you're in business and you're not in, then you've either made too much money so it's not a problem, or you're unlikely.
Or you're a very lucky person, yes.
Yeah, you're a very lucky person.
Well, it's a great, great conversation. And again, I'm just asking these to kind of play devil's advocate, right? Because you have... I've used both contingent and executive search extensively over the last 20 years of running this business. I've had wonderful interactions with my search firms. I've seen some pretty nasty behavior, particularly in the IT sector, but I have very effectively used search and insurance here in the United States for my own business, and have gotten a lot of value out of it. So everything's always a two-edged sword. You know, it's an interesting business. So yeah. Rob Galbraith, what you got?
Yeah, Alex, so great to have you on. And I'm actually happy that the microphone is turned a bit, because you are a host of a podcast, Alex, and I've had the pleasure of being a guest on your podcast. So I've got some hard-hitting questions here for you. But very quickly, I wanted to give you the opportunity to just do a quick plug of your podcast, tell people what it's about, where to find it.
Oh, it's very kind of you. Yeah. So I run the Leadership and Insurance podcast. Both of these fine gentlemen have been guests at different times. We talk about innovation in insurance. We wanted to call it the Innovation Insurance Podcast, but one already exists, so don't subscribe to that one. But we wanted to make sure that we were not excluding the traditional incumbent insurance industry, because innovation happens across the industry. And I think if you put innovation in the title, people leap to technology. But we don't just talk about technological innovation. We talk about innovative working practices. We talk about how to do innovation at scale. We talk about entrepreneurship. So anything where there's a sort of innovative edge within the insurance space, we have those guests on. And it's typically C-suite execs from, you know, the sort of insure tech market, but we have people that we like to term as futurists and authors like yourself, Rob, and then we have people running kind of technology businesses like James, and so we've had a variety of people from the very, very big. We've been lucky enough to get a few unicorns on through to the very small. As long as they're doing something interesting, then we always want to have them as a guest on the show.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Definitely check it out. One of the my favorite conversations of the podcast that I've had the pleasure to be a guest on. So thanks for the opportunity, Alex. So let's talk about the state of talent in the insurance industry. And I'm really specifically interested. We've talked a little bit about some of the incumbents, but what sort of talent are insurtech startups looking to get, and how can these startups be effective in attracting the talent? And I find it fascinating. You know, I think of people involved in startups, and there's many examples of being, you know, from outside the industry, right? We hear the term disruption, et cetera. But then I look at folks such as my old employer, USAA. Their chief claims officer had been there 20-some years, you know, leaving the company to become the chief claims officer, similar position at Lemonade. And I've heard, you know, recently that, you know, several of the folks that had previously worked from, you know, kind of made that move underneath them. So it's fascinating, right? In the past, it would be maybe an Allstate or somebody else that would kind of, you know, take that talent, another incumbent. But we're starting to kind of see folks make the leap from incumbent insurers to insurtech startups. But we also know that they're getting talent elsewhere. So I would love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, it's been really interesting. So I spent, as we were saying, sadly, a long time in the recruitment sector in the insurance. So 15 years and the last five have been, the last three truly, but five I've been kind of, you know, touching base with the insurtech industry and what they've wanted has changed over time. There's been this evolution and it follows the kind of evolution of what we saw in the insurtech market. So there was a lot of distribution plays and therefore you needed people that could sell. You needed people who knew the insurance industry and could build partnerships. So they were taking a lot of talent there. And then now we're moving into a sort of product-led space where we're seeing a lot of kind of SaaS solutions and we're seeing a lot of kind of product-led people joining. But we're also seeing a maturity of the market. So now there is a mature insurtech market. So people are moving from insurtech to insurtech. And I think both sides, insurance and technology businesses, are a little bit in love with their own state of being. So, you know, tech people sometimes think that insurance people don't understand, and insurance people think that tech people don't understand. And the truth is somewhere in the middle. And, you know, the best teams are balanced teams. And I think, you know, talking about how can a startup attract talent, it's about honesty and transparency. I think this is where people get into trouble, but this applies to big businesses as well. People will forgive you if you're lacking in certain elements. Like if you're joining a startup, you probably don't have the support you need. You might not even have all the tech that you need. You might not have the kind of numbers of people that you need, time in the day, and you're going to work hard and probably get paid less than you should do. That's fine, as long as we're upfront and honest. So one of the things that we do with our business is that we always tell people, you construct a pitch deck for your investors. Why have you not got a pitch deck which is specifically for your potential candidates to join your business? So, and what that is it's as honest and as raw as you can make it. You know, things like what's your runway and where are we going with this? Where do you see this in 5 years' time? You know, what are we good at? And what are we not so good at? Where do we have gaps? And if you've got that on this document and if you can present it ahead of time, it doesn't become a problem down the line because people are not taken by surprise. So I think that more than anything is the most important thing. And then just to acknowledge that your job once you start a startup business is to always be recruiting, like constantly. I place people that I've known for 5 years when I've never had the right role for them. And then 5 years down the line, I find it. And the same is true of startups. I think you need to go to as many events as you can, as many meetups as you can. You need to kind of network on things like LinkedIn if it's possible to do so. And like all these things, it feels like a lot, but I think recruitment's like lifting weights at the gym. If you just decide, right, now we've got to hire, or now I've got to get fit for the gym and I'm going to go down there and I'm going to like make magic happen, it doesn't happen. You know, it's very difficult to do. But if you're connecting to 10, 20 people a day on LinkedIn that are relevant to you and your journey, or maybe you will be relevant down the line, when that opportunity comes and the right role comes and that person is in your network, then you're making your life a hell of a lot easier.
Yeah, I love that analogy. You know, if you're going to run the marathon the weekend, right? Start training on Tuesday. Yeah, it makes absolute sense.
Yeah. I mean, it's I was laughing because I was supposed to do a marathon last weekend. I hadn't done the training, so I didn't do it.
So let's talk about this for a second. Most of your placements, right? When people are there, you're executive retained search, right? You're not doing a lot of contingency work.
Yeah. Yeah. Most of it. Yeah.
Most of it's executive retained. So you're recruiting C-suite. And most of your clients are insurance companies, not insurtechs. Is that correct?
No, most of my clients are now insurtechs. It used to be insurance carriers and brokers, but now it's almost exclusively insurtechs.
What are insurtechs mainly looking for then? Like, what's the number one job title they're looking for with you?
It's a fight at the moment between, well, no, it's not a fight. No, what is it? It's business development. It's business development people. Because most of the insurtechs are effectively selling SaaS of some description, and they need salespeople that understand the insurance market. Or some, well, oh, some are happy for them not to, but they still need good salespeople, sales leadership, and that might be in different geographies, but that applies whether we're talking about European businesses or US businesses. The reason I hesitated is just there seems to be a huge demand for product people at the moment. And I think that's a little bit reflective of the entrepreneurs we're seeing launching insurtechs has changed slightly. And I think we're seeing more people leaving the insurance industry to start insurtechs. And what they don't have is that technical product management skill set. So they're looking to bring that in, whereas they've got the kind of distribution sales, business development element. So it's interesting how the entrepreneur has changed the profile, and therefore the kind of demand has shifted slightly on what people are looking for as the probably most common hire that we make.
Sure, and look, it makes sense that sales is your chief demand, in particular if they're venture funded, because those are all valued off growth rate, and they raise money off growth rate, they exit off growth rate. It's all growth rate of ARR, right? So that's the entire objective, and they're all looking to grow faster and try and buy relationships and accelerate growth. We're in a slightly different boat. We're very interested in growth rate, but we're a bootstrap company, and so it makes you make decisions a little bit differently, because you're always looking at keeping a bit more of a balanced plate of balancing sales, marketing, operations, support, and development, so that you can have a financially sustainable business. So it's a little bit of a different mix, but certainly growth is important. I'm always managing or dealing with something in sales every day. Right, I'm an insurtech. I've got two insurance software products, both SaaS. One does certificate of insurance collection and tracking, smart compliance. One does insurance claims management and now policy, and that's the TerraClaim. They're built for TPAs and self-insured groups. So I am firmly up in that business. Salespeople are hard to find, hard to come by. It's hard to find guys that can produce and close deals. It doesn't always matter if they have insurance experience, right? Because you can teach them enough but it's really hard to find people who are fearless and willing to get on the phone and call people. What do you find makes a really great business developer? Because this, by the way, would apply to the broking business, as you would call it, what we call a broker. The same thing. What makes a great salesperson?
Yeah, people who are always trying to buy a Rolodex, right? That's what people try and hire, and I don't think it's relevant. It's about tenacity. It's about having smart sales skills. It's knowing what a good sales process looks like. It's like knowing what a good methodology looks like, and knowing how hand in hand sales goes with the rest of the business. Now, the best salespeople I know are involved in product conversations, they're involved in marketing conversations, they're involved in kind of strategic planning conversations. Because again, I think the way that we buy has changed. I think what we're looking for is that genuine consultative sales. I think consultative sales has been overused as a term, because it's been almost kind of like co-opted to mean selling but not aggressively. And I don't think that's true. I think you can sort of aggressively consultatively sell. But gone are the days where it was about just jumping on the phone, because we now know all the information that we need to know is pretty much at our fingertips. So getting on a call without a why for your client, you want to be open-minded, but you at least want to have an idea as to why your service and or your product is of value. And then you need to be able to follow a process. The best people I meet quite often surprise me that they're incredibly successful in sales. So some of it's a bit hidden. They almost come across like really slick.
They always interview well, Alex, sales is one of the highest turnover positions at tech companies because they interview so well, they sell themselves so well, and then they come into your organization and often underperform so badly. You know,
but some of that's a two-way street because they have to take on face value what the product can do, and particularly if they're in a sector where they're not as knowledgeable. And then there's this like, right, we're selling some, I don't know, claims software, and we're selling it to carriers, but we don't know that actually all the carriers are in 3-year deals with this like massive tech company that actually dominates the market, and you can't sell it. And the most,
which
the
is
most
by the way, of, why I don't sell claim software to carriers, by the way, that's
exactly right. And you know that, but there are people out there trying to build claim software to sell to carriers, and they probably don't know that. And then they get the salesperson and go, we can't sell. And it's like, well, no, it's because no one can sell. I mean, I liken it to this. My friend of mine used to work in pharmaceutical sales. And in the UK, obviously, we would have National Health Service. So if you want to sell pharmaceuticals, you have to sell to the National Health Service. So he would have his like clutch of, they have these trusts, which is like they group hospitals together and they'll be in a trust. And he had his target list of trusts to sell this one drug. And the NHS just blanket went, for these trusts, we're not buying that drug. And sometimes you can be, he's a great sales guy, but he's like,
you can't.
He's in a market where he's got certain clients and none of them will buy it. And I think you're right. Of course you're right. You know, salespeople are better at selling themselves in interviews than most people. Interviews are set up for people that like to talk, who can communicate well and tell stories. That's what interviews are, is a swapping of stories. And so, yeah, more often than not, they underperform against that story. But I do think there's plenty of good people that fall between the cracks because they buy into the company and actually it's a product that can't be sold. But that's where referencing becomes important. That becomes, you know, if this person's done that 3 times in a row, then you kind of got to worry about their judgment anyway. I think that's why you have to take the whole history into account. You're allowed a couple of misfires that you can blame on the company, and then it's definitely about you.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. You know, biz dev, sales. I will say I've met a ton of founders. Some are very effective at selling their company, but just as many, in my experience, if maybe you know more than other startups, like the founder actually isn't the most effective salesperson for his or her company. And you know, they can be brilliant, they can have a vision, whatever, but they're not always the most effective, quite frankly, in articulating that, particularly as somebody that's been on that enterprise client, you know, seen hundreds if not thousands of pitches over 25 years, had the budget authority, right, had to kind of decide, you know, which ones are we buying, why, what's the sales process it look like. So definitely something that founders, I think, often have a blind spot in terms of how effective they are and versus getting, like you said, folks that are really qualified in enterprise sales, things like that. I'm curious, what are more broadly, like what are the biggest lies that founders tell themselves about recruiting?
Look, to be a founder, you've got to be really passionate and you've got to really believe you're going to be successful. And I think one of the biggest lies that people tell themselves when they're recruiting is that people coming into the business have to care about the business as much as you do. Because it's not possible. They're not a co-founder. They don't have the stake that you do. It's not their baby. You know, like... I think most of the problems and the lies actually stem from that one instance. Another big one is that, you know, the sort of, we only hire the best of the best of the best, and then they're not using any external recruitment support, they're hiring from within their own network. Can't possibly be true. But and I know we're going to talk about that as a standalone thing, so I'm not going to dive into that too much.
No, go for it. That was going to be my next question. Go for it.
Yeah. Well, I want to just come back to the sort of business owner thing as well, though, because I think it's in line with the selling question. Like, so the best people at sales actually listen more than they sell. And I think when you're trying to sell to talent, you need to listen. Like, it's mostly about, my job is mostly about listening to what people truly want and trying to read between, asking, spending enough time with them asking enough questions that I go, okay, in this next move, this person wants X, Y, Z, and it could be more freedom, it could be more flexibility. It's very rarely about money. It's almost always about some sort of personal mission. And the example I would use is this, right? So let's say you've got there's a few insurtechs coming out now that are tackling climate change and using insurance as a vehicle, you know, whether it's kind of related to kind of carbon capture or something like that. So the mission is actually tackling climate change. But some of them are using really, really advanced machine learning and analytics. If you're an engineer joining that business, your mission personally might be to advance the use of machine learning and artificial intelligence just as a tool. But they're selling you on this climate change agenda, and it just might not resonate with you at all. So I think that is the biggest lie anyone tells themselves, is that everyone's doing this for the same reason that I am. And we talk lots about missions and people have to be on the mission. And look, I understand that people do need to pull in the same direction, but that direction just needs to be forward. And it doesn't matter if they're doing it for slightly different reasons. Like, you know, they all want to get home from the space shuttle. It doesn't matter, like, if their reasons are different to yours, as long as we're going back to Earth. You know, that's the kind of like the sort of lazy analogy I like to use. Yeah, I think the best of the best of the best is I could do a whole monologue for about an hour on this, I think. But it's particularly insidious at the moment because, you know, everyone's obviously rightly trying to address diversity, equity, inclusion imbalances, particularly with the insurance industry. Tech's slightly better, but not much. Insurance is particularly bad. I think like 70, there's some like the statistics are staggering, which is like essentially there's more women working in insurance than there are men, but there's this minuscule percentage of businesses that are led by women. The same for women getting investment, you know, women trying to start insurtechs are getting very little investment. And so we're seeing the same challenges. So people are kind of rightly starting new insurtech businesses and then saying like, this is key, this is important to us, this is a driver for us. And then they're also saying that we get the best and the best of the best talent. But then you talk to those businesses, and my job is to talk to these businesses every day. It's like, where are you getting your talent from? Oh, internal referrals. Or referrals from our investors. Now, if we're saying the investor pool is not very diverse, and it isn't. It probably looks like us three on this call, which is, you know, a bunch of middle-aged white guys, right? That's the investor pool. And then if we're saying that that investor pool is favoring investing money in people that look like the three people on this call, and then you're using your networks and their networks to fill your talent pools, it is not possible that either you're getting the best of the best of the best because you don't know everybody. And it's definitely not possible that you're doing your best for DE&I, which is, this is where it links back into these are the lies we're telling ourselves. Now, I'm not deluded. It's expensive to use people like me. It takes a certain period of time. It's a cash flow consideration more than anything else as well, because that money has to be paid, you know, upfront at that time. So I'm comfortable with that, but the delusion, I think, impacts the fact that people do anything about it. And there are practical steps that people can take to do something about it. But if they're deluding themselves that going, we're getting the best of the best of the best, and we're solving our kind of diversity, equity, inclusion with our selection, they're actually not addressing it, and they're never going to address it because they're not putting the foundations down to kind of address it in their process, in their procedures. I have to kind of draw the line between getting too angry about it, but it really, really drives me up the wall, because that comes back to that honesty pitch as well. The amount of pitches I see that going, oh, why should you come work for us? It's because like, we're addressing the diversity, equity, and inclusion imbalances. We hire the best of the best of the best. And then I speak to these people, where did you get those people? Oh, we put some adverts up on LinkedIn. We spoke to a couple of guys we knew down the pub. And that's their team. You go, cool.
So you're saying that they got the best of their network.
Exactly.
Yes.
And probably not even that. you know, probably not even that. You know, let's be honest. Like you know, it's the best people in their network that happen to want to move job at that point in time that also happen to want to kind of do the mission that you're on, like, which is an ever decreasing funnel of people. And look, it's obvious that, yeah, you can only hire people that want to come and work with you, but it's a really, really narrow pool. And it's hard. You know, I have empathy, but you can't claim those things and do it that way. You can just do it that way.
You just sound like a hypocrite, right? Like,
yeah.
And
it doesn't get called out enough. But the reason I'm so passionate about it is because of that, the element I talked about before, which is if you say you're doing something, and I don't think people are saying it flippantly, I think they mean it. I think they think they're addressing it. If you're not actually putting the steps in place to address those things, then those things become insidious in your business. So you then grow a business which is not diverse. And then you also kind of, you know, which is damaging to your business as well. We know diverse businesses are more successful over time. So it's the reason I'm kind of so passionate about it is it can become quite toxic. And we're already starting to see it.
All right. Awesome discussion. I'm going to need to move to news, but before I do, I have one shorter question for you that I've actually never asked on the show, but I think I need to start asking it regularly. It has nothing to do with business. Nothing. This is a personal question.
Wow.
What is your favorite guilty pleasure to watch online? What is your favorite guilty pleasure that you want to share? I'm going to share mine with you. I'm going to share mine with you because it's British. I am an Anglophile, okay? I love all things British.
Yeah.
I mean, I love all things British. I like British traditions, British food. I grew up on British TV. I grew up on Blackadder, Red Dwarf, Doctor Who. I grew up on Are You Being Served? I grew up on all of these great British shows, okay?
Yeah.
But I am hooked on a British show that's not on British TV. It is on Facebook. This is so terrible. And you can make fun of me for this. It's called The Hoof GP. And what this guy does is he goes to farms and he trims cows' hooves.
Yeah.
And he is so funny. And it is so interesting that I can't stop watching it. I mean, it's fascinating, the stuff that this guy gets into traveling around the British countryside trimming cows' hooves.
Yeah. Sadly, I've seen a lot of that myself. I find it fascinating.
Fascinating.
I stumbled upon it, and then I just caught, went down this wormhole of watching hundreds of those videos.
Yes.
It's just
so good.
I'm just fascinated that someone's got a job doing that. It's just like...
I know. And how much does he make? The headhunter, and you've got to wonder, how much does this guy make?
Yeah, I always wonder that about everyone I meet. So it's part of the job. Unfortunately, you do size people up. It's like a carpenter looking at a staircase and wondering how it's made. A headhunter meets someone and goes, I've never heard of that job. Wonder what they make. am I in the wrong market? But to answer your question, I was torn between telling you about a film that I'm slightly obsessed with, which is so out of character. I'll tell you about both. So I'm obsessed with horror films. I work at the biggest horror film festival in Europe every year. I actually take time off work to do it. I do their stage management, so I look after the guests that turn up, which is quite funny because in any other festival that'd be like really famous people, but because it's horror, it's usually people you've never heard of. But I'm the nerd that's like, I spotted in a crowd with my partner at the time, and I said, "That's the main character from Human Centipede 3." And she was like, one, I didn't know there was three of them. Two, I'm horrified that you know that. And I'm like, from distance, from like 250 feet, I was like, yeah, that's the guy. And she's like, you're so weird. But I work in this field. I love it. So that's my guilty pleasure. But then that's the thing I always talk about. So to relax, I watch all sorts of horror films. And then the film I really is my guilty pleasure, because I'm always embarrassed about saying I love it, a comedy, because I write comedy, I perform stand-up, and I write for fun, I write screenplays and stuff. And there's a film called Crazy Stupid Love, which is Steve Carell and Ryan Gosling and Julianne Moore. I genuinely think it's a perfect comedy. Like, I don't think there's a wasted scene in it. I think everything is funny. And if I'm ever having a bad day, that is the thing I put on. But it's not the most masculine film. It's like,
even my
girlfriend's like, do you want me to get you a big jar of ice cream? And are you going to sit there and drink some rosé? And I'm like, actually, that would be lovely. Yeah, Thank you very much.
Yes, dear. Like, I love it. I love Emma Stone. Like, I think Emma Stone is brilliant. And I loved La La Land because I'm into musicals. Now, I'll say this. I can't stand horror. Because honestly, it gives me nightmares and I don't sleep. Like it's not because I want to not like it. I literally, my brain is not wired to be able to deal with the scenarios that they go through. And so I love a good rom-com. I love a really good non-horror sci-fi because horror and sci-fi end up getting lumped together a lot.
Yeah.
It really irritates me on like Netflix when they group horror and sci-fi. I'm like, you should not group those two together. But they do. But that's fascinating. Rob, you don't have to share, but do you want to share here?
I have to say I'm a big sports nut. So not necessarily a guilty pleasure, right? But American football, right? World football. I've really gotten into the Premier League this year, and the Champions League has obviously been going on. Big hockey fan from my days in Michigan. Big NBA fan, obviously being here in San Antonio. Nice. Spurs just got eliminated from the playing game. Big NFL fan, of course, right? I don't like baseball. Like, the summers tend to get a bit lean, especially with the World Cup now being in like November and December this year, other than the summer where it's typically proper. So, you know, I don't consider any of that guilty pleasure. So I actually don't watch a lot of films. I don't watch a lot of shows. I guess I would say that I'm with you, James. I really don't like horror. Like, a little bit of there's like kind of a suspense to gore ratio that's right for me. If it's got a lot of suspense and a little bit of gore, like, I'm okay. But at a certain point, it kind of like, you know, tips the balance. So I guess I would say that I like the early versions of things like Harry Potter or Lord of the Rings, or I just saw the trailer for Stranger Things 4, and it's like, I love the original Stranger Things. Like, it was just a lot of drama. But then, like, increasingly it's 2, 3, and now seeing the trailer for 4, like, they just up the gore ratio because they have to kind of constantly like one up. If you think about the last Harry Potter versus like the early, they got their acceptance letter to Hogwarts, right? And So I always hit kind of a tipping point where it's like too much for me. My kids will watch it. My 12-year-old, I mean, they love it, right? But like, it's actually too much for me. So I don't know, that's like an inverse of a guilty pleasure, but I always like the sweet, innocent beginnings of many of these franchise series.
There you go. Well, let's move on to news. That's our guilty pleasures. We got to be really quick on the news. I've got a couple of stories here. Number one, Rob, and I had to mention this because it's you and it came up on my InsurTech feed, is a former employee of yours, AF Group, got into a transaction, and they entered an agreement to purchase Ameritrust Group. And so I saw that happen this week. There was a transaction there. Where they're welcoming Ameritrust expertise in property casualty space to further their specialty in work comp products and lines of insurance. And so just a little mention there about AF Group. And also in InsurTech news, this is a really interesting one. Insurance brokerage platform Newfront raised $200 million. So usually our announcements are like 10 million, 15, 20. This was led by a growth equity business within Goldman Sachs. Newfront says they're trying to transform delivery of risk management, employee experience, insurance, and retirement solutions in a modern insurance platform. So they raised $200 million on that front. So I just had to mention that. Rob?
Yeah, I thought you were going to quote that very famous kind of Austin Powers, right? British, like, or was it Dr. Evil, the $200
million dollars.
So I've got a couple of quick items as well. This one kind of caught my eye. This is from Coverager, that the specialty car insurer Haggerty, based in Traverse City, Michigan. They do a lot of antique classic cars. Yep. Have actually, ironically, always been a very innovative insurance company. They acquired Speed Digital, which is a provider of cloud technology solutions for dealers, auction houses, collectors, and enthusiasts. So Speed Digital is founded in 2019. They help 200 plus dealers manage over 8,200 collector cars in inventory for sale, helps them manage their car collection digitally. It's behind an online marketplace. And so I just found this fascinating that it was a straight out acquisition. So the type of thing that it makes a lot of sense, like Speed Digital, Haggerty, I'm sure there's some type of, you know, partnership, relationship, referrals, right? That you can see where the synergy, but the fact that Haggerty, right, is this kind of traditional insurance company, is making the outright acquisition, I found, you know, quite interesting and innovative. So I'd be curious to kind of see, you know, where they take that. And then this one, and Alex, would love your thoughts on this one from the Insurance Journal, but they cite, this is 1 or 2 days in the office is the sweet spot of hybrid work. They're citing a study that was in Harvard Business Review that said people that spent between 25 and 40% of their time in the office evidently turned out more original work than other groups. And their finding was that the difference was significant. So we've talked a little bit on this podcast about return to work. Not everyone's all in and going back to the office. People do want to do business travel, go to some of these in-person conferences that are going on, but I think they're a little skeptical about going back to that kind of open floor plan cubicle environment, you know, being interrupted 20 times a day by your colleagues. So Alex, I'm curious kind of your thoughts. You agree with this 1 to 2 days in the office? Is that what you're hearing? Or is this not necessarily aligned with what you're hearing with some of the folks you talk with?
Yeah, I think anecdotally, that's absolutely what people are doing. I think you'd be very hard pressed to get people in the office 5 days a week now. I just don't think anyone's interested in tolerating it. And it's even opened up the conversation about, do we need to work 5 days a week? You know, could we work four? Because there's been some great studies done in Europe where productivity went up in highly productive countries in Scandinavia, where they did 4 day weeks and people did more work. So 4 day week, 2 days in the office, revolutionary, but surely it's kind of got to lean towards that. But yeah, anecdotally, people are, interestingly, I think everyone fell in love with the kind of work from home, but there's
not
been
everybody.
Yeah, well, yeah, there has definitely been a kind of return to work and people have enjoyed that. But I think people are viewing the work time differently. So it's interesting you said about creative work, because I think having that piece of having your own time at home where you're uninterrupted to kind of get on with productive work and then having some colleagues to kind of bounce ideas around, I think that balance is absolutely correct. I mean, that's definitely what we're going to be doing. We're moving offices at the moment, but I think the plan is to have a clubhouse and we won't have, you know, we won't be growing out a business where people are in 5 days a week. I just don't see that happening.
Yeah, we'll see. I think we're seeing a lot of companies pulling back to the office now a lot more aggressively for a lot of reasons. And they're, for people who are deciding to move away and permanently go work from home, they're starting to cut pay and change benefits and not pay Californians California wages when they're in Idaho. And you know, the brutal, cold, hard reality is settling in. Of course, public tech prices have also impacted that too, right? When their stock price is a good bit lower, that impacts what they're going to pay people. So interesting conversation. Great. Thanks for the news, Rob. And Alex Bond, cousin to James Bond, thank you for being on our show. Really appreciate you being here.
No, thank you, gents. I've really enjoyed talking to you, and it's nice to be on the other end of the podcasting. So thank you very much.
Absolutely. Rob Galbraith, always good to see you.
Always great to see you, James. Great conversation, Alex. So glad you could join us.
This has been the InsurTech Geek podcast, powered by JB Knowledge. That's jbknowledge.com. It's all about transforming and disrupting the insurance world. I've been your host, James Benham. That's jamesbenham.com with co-host Rob Galbraith. That's endofinsurance.com. Big thanks to Jim Greenlee, our podcast producer, Kara Dalton-Alaro, our creative producer. And thank you for joining us today. We're taking you on a journey through insurance tech. So enjoy the ride and geek out. See you next time.